This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a better time to do business in Western Australia. Our network of global investment and trade offices connects you to our world-leading industries and highly skilled workforce. Western Australia. It's like no other.
Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. As you know, we build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do on BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. There's a whole range of things in this week's programme, as is always the case, but particularly why trees are so important to inner city areas. Much as I dislike starting on a down note, we're facing a catastrophe, friends. It's a bit like the ravens leaving the tower or the apes leaving the rock. This morning I got as far as Aberdeen and realised I'd left the firewood at home. There is no fire this morning in the car park in Beechgrove, Aberdeen. I am a saddened and chastened Mark Stephen standing here, no fire. 40 miles to the north, not caring less about this, frankly. Mr. Ewan McElraith.
No, I'm not bothering at all because I've been arm wrestling with a blackbird and a thrush this morning for the last of the raspberries, and I'm just picking the seeds out of my mouth as we speak. Wonderful way to start the day. You can do better than that. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 and your standard network message rate will apply. And you can call Finn on 0885 92 95 00.
See, we don't bother growing our own raspberries. We just eat the wild ones down on the bottom of the road.
Yeah, but these are big and there's lots of them.
Size isn't ever... Oh, well, there's lots of the wild ones too. Lovely and sweet. I was having some last night. The weather's been a definite talking point this week. Some very, very high temperatures across the country. Has it affected you? We'll discover if trees could actually help.
Yeah, and I've been finding out how wildlife and flora can recover after a wildfire. But first of all, the high excitement of the day. The mystery bird returns. See if you can work out what this is, and it's difficult. Well, I wouldn't have got it. No. Outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or give Finn a call. He will have a busy morning once we start giving clues. 0885 92 95 00.
You sure that's not the one we did last week?
It sounds a bit like a herring gull. There's a top clip for you. Top clue for you. It's not a herring gull.
Well, there you go. The soft fruit season is in full swing, as we've been saying, what with raspberries and all. And I dropped in past the James Hutton Institute on the outskirts of Dundee on Thursday, where they were holding an event called Fruits for the Future. It's their annual showcase of soft fruit research for the food and drink industry, and there's astonishing things going on down there. Dr. Susan McCallum has the glorious title of Blueberry Researcher, and we're headed straight to the polytunnels.
We've got some blueberries, so these were freshly picked this morning. We've got some strawberries. We've started to do some work looking at different varieties and how they perform here in Dundee. We've got some blackberries. We have different currants. We have black currants, red currants and white currants. These are a couple of new breeding programmes that we've started looking at. We have our red raspberries and we have our cherries, which are picking fantastic this year.
I have to say... These are monsters.
They are.
The blueberries are the size of strawberries. The blackberries are just enormous. They're like small plums. Ditto the cherries. I mean, huge things.
They really are, and they're tasting fantastic this year. I think because we've had such warm weather and a lot of nice sunlight, it really has helped the fruit to develop beautifully.
Say we take the first one, blueberries. You know, what makes for a perfect blueberry nowadays? What are you aiming to do when you're trying to breed them?
For me, a perfect blueberry will be made in Scotland. That's the starting point. But it has to be an all-rounder. It has to have the good size. It has to have a nice fruit size for picking. Mm-hmm. Picking is becoming incredibly expensive now, so it has to be efficient for the pickers to pick it, and it has to fill upon it quickly. It has to look nice. It has to have that nice bloom, so it looks appetising, it looks fresh. And then it has a bite, so a nice crisp texture and a good balance of sugar and acid. You don't want it too sweet if it doesn't have that acidic balance, because then it just tastes a bit of nothing, a bit watery. So we're looking for something that's got the sugar, but it's got that nice acidic bite to it, and then it's just beautiful.
And how do you go about doing that? With things like, there are blueberry plants in front of us. Does that have to be picked by hand, or can you pick them mechanically nowadays?
They can certainly be picked mechanically. Again, the problem in the UK is we grow everything, or definitely in Scotland, we have to grow everything under polytunnels. Mm. And we'll have to do that because of the weather, because of to make sure that we get the right temperatures and the right growing hours. So mechanically harvesting it under a tunnel is difficult. Across the Europe and across America, they certainly do mechanical harvesting. What they tend to do is they'll do the first pick fresh, because that's always the biggest fruit when the first pick. So they'll do the first pick fresh, then they tend to go over mechanical harvesting. I think that's something that we will probably have to look at seriously here in Scotland to stay competitive. But at the moment, everything is hand-picked. So that's why when in our breeding programme, we're looking for selections that are, good ripening, so that they're ripening at the same time, so they only need one or two picks. Some of the varieties that we've got in this tunnel, the older cultivars, they take three or four or five picks. So that's not, commercially sustainable. So we're looking for something that's got a good ripeness that you can pick it once or twice.
I can't stand in front of this display without nicking one of the blueberries.
Help yourself, please do.
Just to see what it's actually like. When you are breeding, do you go to the farmers and tell them what they need, or is it more of a sort of conversation and exchange? How do you decide what is optimal?
It's very much a conversation. I mean, our breeding programmes for all of the soft fruit, they are commercially funded. Mm-hmm. So we have private funders that give us the money for these breeding programmes. So they tell us what they want. And, depending on whether they're coming from a propagator background, a lot of them have got good links with the supermarkets. So it's all linked up. We want something that... For the propagators, it has to grow well. It has to be able to be propagated so they're uniform and everything that you get is a really nice plant. It has to be upright. It has to be, an attractive-looking plant. But the quality has to be there. It has to have a good enough yield. If it doesn't have a big enough yield, if it doesn't produce enough berries, it's not competitive right at the start. But then it has to taste good. If the supermarkets don't want it, if the consumers won't go back for it time and time again, then you don't have a product.
That blueberry was delicious, by the way.
Good.
I'm now casting my eyes on the cherries, but I'm going to leave them alone. I'm going to leave them alone at the moment. Is soft fruit growing still to the fore in Scotland? And by that I mean, in the past there was a tremendous reliance on seasonal migrant workers, which is really difficult to get nowadays.
Absolutely. I mean, at the moment, the soft fruit industry to the UK is worth, I think it's just tipped the £1.7 billion mark. The soft fruit that's grown in the UK is worth £700 million, and it's growing year on year. Unfortunately, so too are the challenges. We do have climate change that is here. It's making growing things a little bit difficult. The environmental cues are sometimes out of season. We're having to make sure that the pests and diseases that are coming in, that we're able to recognise them and grow varieties that can adapt to that, that are resilient to these changes.
And the event that you've got this afternoon, who is that aimed at?
That's aimed at anybody that's interested in soft fruit. It's aimed at the growers, it's agronomists, it's members of the public that are just interested to see how
you've got soft fruit in your back garden, you could come along.
Absolutely. Anybody's welcome to come along. Just if they have an interest in soft fruit to see how it's grown, we're happy to give advice. We're more than welcome for people to come in and see what we grow, and we can tell them how best to grow them, what conditions that they need. Because sometimes with blueberry, if you don't have the right soil, it won't do anything. I have a lot of people that have them in the back garden and they just don't produce fruit. And it's because the soil pH is wrong, or they're not feeding it right. Once you adjust that, it will definitely produce, and these plants will produce for 40 years. Easy.
Given the fact that you say that there are a lot of challenges out there, and the challenges seem to be increasing, the science behind this is going to get more and more important.
It definitely is. And the science right now is exciting. You know, we've just started a project, a Horizon 2020 breeding value project, and we have 20 partners over 8 European countries. And we're doing just that. We're looking at the genetics that drive the traits, that the, you know, how the plant performs, whether it's environmentally or genetically, how the taste, how they look. And we're, you know, testing different fruit in the different countries to see how they stand up to climate change and to the resilience of pests and diseases. And by doing that, we can then identify which species are better for breeding. And in this plot here, we've got some wild species. And these are the ones that, you know...
Blaberry, for example. At the back.
Exactly. We've got the blaberry and we've got wild strawberry here. And they grow... obviously wild, without having to put all the inputs in, and because they have they don't taste great, they don't have the production that we would need for commercially, but they do have some really interesting genetics that we can bring into our breeding programme that can help make our blueberries a little bit stronger and a bit more resilient going forward.
Dr. Susan McCallum there, blueberry researcher at the James Hutton Institute. The fruit was mighty fine, I have to say.
Did you bring some back for the team?
No, I didn't bring back anybody anything for anybody. Including me. Including me. They'd obviously, they picked a punnet of each, you know, for the thing in the afternoon. I couldn't nick an entire punnet. That would have been wrong.
I think you
not
have.
Not for the first time.
No, what a great job, though. No, blueberry researcher.
Oh, I remember talking to another scientist there. Oh, must have been about 4 or 5 years ago, and what have you. And as we were walking down the polytunnel, she was just casually picking raspberries off and checking them for sweetness and taste and what have you. And I laughed eventually and I said, any idea how much soft fruit you eat in a day? And she laughed and she said, I worked it out once. She says, I thought it was about 2 kilograms.
Oucha.
That's over 4.5 pounds.
Yeah, but you talking about wild strawberries there. We've got wild strawberries all over the place. I mean, yeah, they don't compete with the commercial stuff, but it's just delightful just picking a wild strawberry as you go past, because they're growing through the cracks in the paving stones.
Yes.
Amazing plants.
Yeah. No, well, going back to the wild raspberries with us, you know, it's food for free. You know, I love being able to walk past and just kind of take a handful of raspberries and enjoy the sweetness.
Do you plant them?
No, I don't need to.
I tend to take a handful of brambles or whatever, but I'll always take one and chuck it into the verge just to propagate the species.
No, our dogs used to do that for us. This week, we've witnessed extreme temperatures both at home and abroad. As a consequence, many wildfires have spread rapidly and caused an awful lot of damage.
Yeah, so what is the impact of these fires on our wildlife and their flora? In 2018, there was a massive fire on the island of Rum. Here's Ian Sargent of Nature Scott.
It was very dry. It was a very dry period. And it was in April, so at the end of the winter, a lot of the vegetation dries out. And unfortunately, someone discarded a cigarette without correctly sort of extinguishing it, and quickly the fire got away. And there was quite a wind, so as the wind sort of picked up and caught the fire spread quite quickly. We had quite a significant fire on our hands.
Because it's very position difficult to get the fire under control. So, you know, it's a mountain.
Yeah, I mean, it was impossible to try and manage that. So we did get a helicopter out to try and control it, but by that point it was really quite a big fire. So we were quite lucky in that when nightfall came, the sort of relative humidity increased, temperatures went down, and actually the fire kind of put itself out. But by that time, it covered about 700 hectares, so it's quite a significant area.
So what was going through folks' minds at that point? Because it's a national treasure in terms of wildlife.
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously, we were massively concerned. It's certainly a big setback to our sort of conservation and habitat restoration. But also, yeah, you've got to think about all the animals as well as the plants that live there. So there was a big concern. Obviously, our immediate concern was with life and property. But thankfully, at that time of year, there wasn't anybody about in the fire, and it was far enough away from where anybody lives. So that was, you know, a small blessing. But yeah, in terms of the impacts to the habitat, then from that point on, we started to try and figure out what the impacts were.
So did the birds just fly away? Or do they get caught in it?
Yeah, so it depends what time of year the fire is, really. Obviously, if it's in the winter, then it'll probably have less of an impact on wildlife. But in the summer, particularly when birds are breeding, there's more invertebrates about, you know, a lot of animals that aren't hibernating, obviously, in the summertime. So it can have a bigger impact. And obviously, ground nesting birds and things would suffer quite badly. The nests would be lost. I mean, obviously, most animals are quite mobile, and so they will be able to move away from the fire. But, yeah, inevitably, there will be some casualties, particularly in the summer, yeah.
But presumably, invertebrates, insects, are going to be massively impacted, and that's a major food source for a lot of the birds and the animals.
Yeah, again, it kind of depends a bit on the time of year. So in April on Rum, you know, there's not so much going on. It's quite a sort of late spring. But, you know, some animals and insects and things will move in quite quickly. Others that depend more on cover or the food might take a bit longer. But generally, it's the habitats that take the longest to recover. Yeah.
Well, what was the impact on the habitat? What kind of plant structure did you have, and what was the impact?
The impacts vary massively between different fires. On Rum, the intensity of the fire was quite low to medium impact. So that means that the fire kind of burnt quite a lot of the vegetation that was above the soil surface. But actually, the soil itself was fairly unaffected, and also the moss layer, which is a really important layer that sits below the sort of vegetation above the soil, that generally was kept intact as well. So that's encouraging. That sort of low to medium impacts, we hope that it will recover relatively quickly. But in some areas, some habitats are particularly vulnerable to fire, so some species are particularly sensitive to fire, and in those circumstances, those habitats, like for example Liverwort Heath is one, they just won't return. Other habitats are more adapted, I suppose, to fire, and they can withstand fire and come back relatively quickly. So yeah, we do have quite a variety of habitats on Rum, and so there'll be different impacts in different areas.
Now, that was 4 years ago. Are you seeing some species making a comeback, or is it succession, you know, one prepares it for the next?
What we've noticed on Rum is that, I mean, very quickly it sort of greened up in the spring with grasses. Particularly, you find grasses come back quite quickly, particularly dominant grasses like purple moorgrass. And that, you know, that's quite good in some ways because it stabilises the soil, but in other ways it's not so good for biodiversity because fire can actually promote purple moorgrass, and it then becomes sort of dominant across the area, which means that other species can't grow and the general sort of species diversity is lower. Purple moorgrass actually sort of grows in tufts, in tussocks, and so it can withstand fire. The fire goes through and burns the edge of the tussocks, but the centre of the plant remains still living, and so it can grow back quite quickly. And it's not palatable for wild herbivores particularly, so that means that it's got a competitive advantage. The herbivores will eat the other species, the palatable heathers, the spring growth on the heather are coming through, rather than the purple moorgrass itself, and so it tends to dominate the area.
Because we're not geared up for forest fires, are we? People always say, you know, nature's resilient, it will bounce back, but we're not really geared up for it, or nature's not in Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, historically, wildfires, we haven't had that many of them, and I think as the climate changes, I think we're going to expect more prolonged drier periods and more frequent and potentially more intense wildfires, and so that is a concern. And obviously, you know, the best thing is prevention. We want to try and prevent wildfires from happening wherever possible, but in terms of dealing with them, it's so difficult because they tend to be over quite large areas, and so it's a real strain on the fire service. They do a great job, but a lot of cases it's just very difficult to manage that. We're relatively well set up in that we've got helicopter services that can assist, but yeah, prevention is better than trying to manage fighting them.
True enough. Ian Sargent, Nature Reserves Manager for Nature Scot. I remember driving past, I took the road that sort of diverges away from Benkruachan at Kilchurn Castle there, and there was a fight. It was getting towards the end of evening and it was getting dark and the entire hillside was ablaze. This must be about 20 years ago. I've still got a photograph of it somewhere. It's scary.
It is scary, and you just wonder how, well, obviously, huge impact on the wildlife, but as Ian was saying, it does make a comeback, but you could argue if this is going to be a more frequent occurrence, in Scotland and in Britain generally, then it's going to have a major impact, because it does take time. If it's a yearly event, it's going to have a massive impact. Mm.
I wonder if anybody's ever done a sort of analysis of how these fires start. You know, and by that I mean, I'm not basically throwing stones at anybody here, but I do wonder how many of them actually start with things like drop cigarettes or, you know, those portable barbecues.
Yeah, portable barbecues. I think the one on Rum was started with a cigarette, but also we're saying some of the ones, big ones in England, are caused by bottles or glasses being left, and the sun's rays focus through the bottle, mm-hmm. and start the fire. Because the argument is, a lot of people don't know that a bottle lying in a dry grassland can cause a fire.
Yeah, I have read that, and you know, intellectually I can accept that. Have you ever tried? Done it with a magnifying glass, but not a bottle.
I haven't tried it with a bottle, but it's incredibly effective with a magnifying glass, so you can see if the sun was hitting the bottle in the right way. It was the head of a fire service, so I wasn't going to argue with him.
No, I mean, let's face it, you know, we've all burnt ourselves with a magnifying glass just to see if it worked. Anyway,
do people do that anymore? Just a thing of the past? You know, people have a magnifying glass.
It's maybe just us. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. Coming up, the cooling effect of trees and a rather remarkable garden makeover.
Yeah, I've had a couple of wrong guesses for the mystery bird already. Alistair Nelgan says, "Good morning, gentlemen. Fine start to the day. There's nothing like a wild raspberry or a strawberry to help weary legs on a walk. For their size, the intense flavour is amazing. Regarding the mystery bird, I'm thinking the talk of gulls is a cunning diversion, so I'll say it's a magpie. Keep up the good work." Well, anyway, lovely for your communication, Alistair. Totally wrong. Forget magpies, think more coastline. And in some parts of the world, it's known as a bald pate. Have a listen. Now, that is a hard one, but it's got a very distinctive mark on its head.
Yes. And I have a clue as well, but I'm not going to do it yet. And I have to say, I'm going to wait till after 7 o'clock. I'm just in that kind of humour today. I've got no fire. Sulking away, bottom lip sticking out.
Black cloud hovering over Beechgrove Gardens.
Don't curse me, thank you very much. If you are exploring a city, is it more likely that you're drawn to the sights of the place rather than its sounds? I don't know. What do you tend to do?
It's an interesting question. Sights. I mean, I'm guilty. I'm coming from the country and I'm just looking at the tall buildings and the lampposts.
And the electricity.
Wow, look at that.
Horseless carriages, look at that. Yeah, quite. Well, anyway, Sound Thought is a collective who are based in Glasgow, and they present curated sound walks in the west end of the city. Now, their aim is to explore the impact humans and noise pollution can have on the environment. I met up with a couple of sound artists, Sonia Kilman and Kevin Leomo, in Kelvingrove Park in Glasgow.
The idea is to kind of listen on headphones on a device in situ, but also as we walk and we kind of do these tours, obviously we take the headphones off and we listen to the environment and kind of discuss things as we go. So it's really quite an intimate experience. We do it with kind of small groups, and by the end, usually people have changed how they listen, or they realize, oh, I haven't heard that sound before, or I can hear the traffic now a lot. And it's really interesting seeing people kind of open their ears to these sounds.
Welcome to the Sound Walk. Open yourself to the location you are in. Open your ears. What sonic details can you hear? What constitutes the characteristics of the soundscape?
I'm picking up all sorts of stuff there. I'm hearing traffic noise, I'm hearing trains, I'm hearing sirens in the background, all that kind of thing. Did you start this project during COVID?
Kind of 2021, so I think we were still in various states of lockdown. And I think that was one of the reasons we kind of designed to deliver this sort of project, because previously our organization, Sound Thought, was maybe doing more kind of concerts or festivals. And this is the first time I think we had done something kind of sound walk and something you could take outdoors and do individually as well. So it was kind of designed with COVID in mind.
Obviously, the reason I asked that was because certainly during the first lockdown, so many people said, the birds are singing louder. I can hear something. You couldn't hear traffic. You couldn't. I mean, I remember the first time, you know, a plane went across us. You know, we were in a major flight path. We got really excited. Went, ooh, you know, didn't like it in a way. But it's strange. People started using their senses in a different way.
Oh, yes, for sure. I feel like, I mean, the term deep listening has existed for a long time, but I feel like during COVID especially, you could really hear things that normally traffic noise masks a lot. And it was really an opportunity for us to also find a way to, you know, also meditate on the sounds around us and really actually become aware of how much sound influences also the environmental health. Because if there's traffic noise, the birds can't communicate, so they can't mate and they can't reproduce, and they ultimately, it means that bird species will die out, and that happens with a lot of other animals as well, also, who are just relying on being able to move around a city. If there's always cars, you know, it just corners them in a way. So I feel like we also try to put awareness onto the fact that we need to be more kind to our surroundings, because nature is still in a city. We just can't see or hear it most of the time.
Take a look at the river. Either as you're sitting on a bench, walking past it, or looking down at it from a bridge. Observing and feeling the current of the stream. How fast is the river flowing? Is the water level unusually high or low? What color is the stream? Does the current of the Kelvin seem calm or wild?
It's a mindfulness exercise, being aware of what's around you.
Oh, definitely. That's definitely something we wanted to tap into. And I think this idea of we're kind of coming out of lockdown, and it also kind of tied in with, there was kind of ideas of rewilding and the idea of kind of nature having a bit more space to kind of breathe and come back in as, you know, the traffic was dying down during COVID and we weren't out as much. And yeah, just kind of getting people to be aware of these things and be aware of the environment and listen to environmental sounds. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we've really enjoyed doing with the sound walks, is getting people to open their ears and be more aware, and not just for the sound walks, but something they can take away in their wider, you know, lives, and just being more aware and I guess mindful.
Kevin Leomo and Sarah Kilman of the Sound Thought Collective, based in Glasgow. If you'd like to hear more of my sound walk, take a listen to the latest edition of Scotland Outdoors, which is available now on BBC Sounds. Here's the thing, you know, and I don't wish to sound bitter here. Why are we not sound artists?
You know what, I've actually jotted that down on a bit of paper in front of me.
How come?
Why are we called broadcasters and not sound artists?
I don't know.
You know, because we're sculpting with a microphone. You're creating a picture. Your microphone is a paintbrush to the world.
Yes.
Just don't think we get the appreciation we deserve on this program.
I have to say, using my microphone as a paintbrush has made somewhat of a mess of the grey fluffy cover.
Yes.
Maybe if I'd used water-based paint, it might have been better.
I'm looking at my big fluffy cover at the moment, and it's a little singed at the end because I was trying to record a bonfire.
Yeah,
that lovely smell of burning.
Oh, we've all done it. I can't. Where was it? It was on the Isle of May. I was across with three guys from the British Trust for Ornithology, and we had got soaked. I mean, absolutely soaked to the drawers. And we came back. We were staying in the lighthouse keeper's cottage, and I took the furry cover off the microphone cage. And you remember those old-fashioned gas, you know, cookers that had the eye-level grill? The grill was not on, right? And I put this thing on top because there was, you know, the gas was on, right? Because they were making soup or something like that, I don't know. But I thought, well, maybe hot air will rise and it'll help dry it a bit. So I just stuck it on top of the, you know, the absolute top of the grill. It wasn't in the grill, it was on top of the grill. And about 20 minutes later, one of the guys came through and says, I put some sausages on, Mark. Would you like a sausage?
Oh, no.
And I shot out the chair too late. It was just a melted grey plastic puddle by the time I got there.
Have you ever tried to claim a grey plastic puddle on expenses? People just don't take you seriously. Because there's no legislation in the BBC for stupidity.
Yeah, no, there's none. Absolutely none. I still look back on that happy day when somehow... Because BBC, I have to say, BBC expenses are really quite stringent. You know, they're very, very careful. They're very particular. No, no, you can't do that because it was on a Tuesday and there's an hour in the month. But remember the time you got a bottle of whiskey by them somehow? Nobody knows how.
We'll gloss over that. A couple of correct answers on the board. Colin and Mary Abercrombie and Dunblane got it right. Ian and Tully Nessel got it right as well.
Coming up, we've also got the parterres of Pitmedden, or the new parterres of Pitmedden, and the beauty of the bog.
Yeah, and the mystery bird. A couple of wrong answers. David Chadwick and Carl Luke says, is it a French partridge? No, it's stuck at Dover. Moira Toohey and Roddy Ferry says, is it a heron? And Mark's going to give you a clue after this. This is the same bird, but it's a really different noise. Have a listen to this. Ooh. And your clue is? Would you get
right, I'd get closer from that one. I would get closer from that. Right, my mystery clue is, and it's a cryptic one, it is the object of the desire at the end of Homer's Iliad. No, the Odyssey. The Odyssey.
You're broadcasting to the wrong people.
No, I don't think I am. I don't think I am. It is a cryptic clue and it will help you.
Okay. 0808 592 9500 if you're reaching for your Latin dictionary. Finn's taking your call and frankly he's a bit perplexed this morning. And you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Go and say the clue again because you fumbled it last time.
It's the object of the desire at the end of Homer's Odyssey. Okay, it's cryptic clue. Ross from Tainholt thought the Mr. Bird might be a fulma. He is lying in his tent near Uppsala in Sweden. Says, I couldn't afford to miss today's Mr. Bird, so tuning in on my phone an hour ahead. Dirty lucky devil. Andrew Barry in Roman Camp, West Lothian, thought it might be a golden eye. Spanner from Nairn says, out for my warning walk on Nairn Beach, listening as usual to the show. I've never any idea what the bird of the week is until this morning. Is it a heron? No, I'm afraid to say, Spanner, you're carrying right along the right line.
Think seabird.
Something like that. Tommy Lavelle in Glasgow says, imagine forgetting the fire. Don't rub it in, Tommy. The mystery bird today is that. Is it a golden eagle? No, it's just a raven, as said on many a mountain trip. It's not. Today's an interesting one, too. Ian Johnson's come in saying, we've noticed a really large number of magpie moths in our part of Aberdeenshire recently, where previously we saw maybe only one or two a year of these lovely, strikingly coloured moths. They seem to be everywhere and in large numbers. We're wondering what's behind the big increase and whether it's a local phenomenon or more widespread across the country.
I don't think I've ever seen one. Are they black and white, presumably?
They are. They're really beautiful animals. The first time I saw one was up in Orkney, and I have to say, I did see one in our drive. Sadly, it was attached to the front of my daughter's car. I should obviously hit it at some speed, but they are lovely little creatures. We will try and find out for you in Ian and Linda in Tully Nessel. Anyway, yesterday I was lucky enough, not that terribly far away from where I live, to have a sneak preview of the gardens at Pitmedden in Aberdeenshire. Now, the upper terrace parterre has been closed for a grand makeover by designer Chris Beardshaw. And tomorrow, they open to the public for the first time in quite a while. I asked Chris, how do you go about doing something like this?
So the gardens at Pitmedden, of course, have been known for a long time for their parterre which essentially is a sort of pattern on the ground. It's a series of low hedges that traditionally were filled full of bedding plants, generally in fairly gaudy colours, and it was all about vibrancy. It's almost like a sort of living stained glass window, if you like. And there was a terrace at Pitmedden that was sort of underdeveloped and underperforming. And it's one of the higher terraces that links the house to the old walled garden. And that was just, well, essentially hedges and grass. There's virtually nothing there. Certainly nothing of any horticultural merit and nothing that really enhanced the visitor experience. So you've got an interesting building, a series of terraces, and then these fabulous parterres. And what we needed to do was to try and create a piece of horticultural tapestry which was going to provide a more contemporary approach to the creation of a parterre, embracing issues such as biodiversity, resource management, creating a really strong floral aesthetic reward, allowing people to experience a parterre in a slightly different way. Of course, traditionally, you look at parterres from above. As we're standing here now, leaning against the wall, looking down into the old parterre, you see it from above, almost like looking at a painting. And what we wanted to do with a new parterre is to allow people to be immersed in it, to walk through the pattern on the ground, using a load of plants that were going to create a robust community and be very resilient and deliver throughout the year. So no matter what time of the year you come, there is this sort of ebbing and flowing of floral bounty. And that really is the brief in a nutshell.
Did you have an absolutely blank canvas, or did you have to nod respectfully towards past habits here, mirror what was going on?
Well, there was an element of absorbing the information that came from the gardening team, both within the Pitmedden team, but also, of course, across the trust, gleaning information about what grows well in this particular climate, what they've wanted to grow that they hadn't had the opportunity to try. So there was an element of absorbing that, and it became this kind of magical wish list of plants. But also there was an element of trying to historically make it appropriate. And for those that visit the new parterre, you'll see that there's an intricate pattern of grass paths that carve their way through the terrace. And when you look at that in plan, that pattern is directly taken from one of the original pencil sketches that was drawn by André Le Nôtre, who is responsible for Vaux-le-Vicomte and, of course, the Palace of Versailles. Now, the reason that that's an important link is because the original family here at Pitmedden had links with Le Nôtre and, we believe, visited Vaux-le-Vicomte when he was sketching out these designs. And we've been able to take one of his original sketches, a section of it, and reimpose it here at Pitmedden. So there is a kind of contextual relevance to the patination in the ground today.
Phil, a garden like this, I mean, and it's busy today. People wander about. It's only 4 or 5 miles away from where I live. We come here regularly. We love it here. Why is this significant? Why is it culturally important?
Well, I think gardens like Pitmedden and the many places across the National Trust for Scotland are so significant in people's minds, really for very many reasons, but especially in the last 2 years, we've seen what a haven they've become for people. People come here to be nourished, refreshed, to very simply be out in the open air and be inspired by natural and, of course, designed beauty. It's a historic garden in its origin. It dates back, we think, at least to the 17th century. But at the Trust, we care for the history of these places, but that doesn't mean that they need to stand still. Gardens are constantly evolving things, and I think that what has been done here is through Chris's design and by the hard work of the team at the National Trust for Scotland is to create something which is incredibly sensitive to the history of the garden design, to Scotland's international links in the 17th and 18th century and onwards, and also create something wholly modern, which will be part of Scotland's garden heritage for the future.
It's not just heritage. This crosses my mind every time I come here. Somewhere like this also gives professional gardeners a chance to practice on a much bigger canvas than they would be able to otherwise.
Well, we're very proud of being able to undertake this commission, which has been possible through a very generous donation to the Trust. Of course, so much of our charitable funds go into simply the conservation and maintenance of our places. And it is fantastic to have an opportunity, really quite a rare opportunity, in fact, to be able to commission commission something new, to work with designers now. And I very much hope it's something that we can do more of in the future. Chris's work, of course, is sought after around the world. And so we're very, very pleased and proud to have an example of his design now here in Aberdeenshire, with which, of course, he is so strongly associated as well.
I should have started off by saying congratulations on your most recent goal at Chelsea. How many is that now?
Well, I must be honest, I had actually, it sounds very arrogant, but I actually forgotten until someone at the BBC came onto the garden and said, I believe this is number 14.
That's just greedy.
Which is, in a way, I couldn't have stopped at 13, could I?
No, that would be wrong.
That would have just, you know, someone could have suggested that was unlucky. So yeah, but you know, any garden, no matter whether it's a show garden or whether it's a garden that's going to persist for generations, you'd know that they're transformative spaces. They're spaces where, as we just heard, that, you know, people come and they find themselves. They shape people's lives. They change our emotions. They create bonds between people and places. And gardens are not just the green spaces between buildings. They are the spaces around which buildings are able to exist. And I think that mind shift allows us to really elevate gardens to, you know, the same status as any work of art, because that's really what we're creating here, is a horticultural work of art. And it takes a certain skill level to be able to maintain it. And that's thanks to the garden team here and the bravery to initiate it in the first instance. And I think one of the things that's worth pointing out here at Pitt Medden is that the archaeology and the research that was carried out across the site indicated that this terrace, where the new parterre is, had very little of historic importance on it, unlike some of the other areas of the site. And so with all of the information, archaeology and archive and the research that was carried out, it was very, very clear that if this garden was going to move forwards, not just into this century, but moving forwards beyond that, then this was absolutely the space where the garden gave us permission to create this floral tapestry.
Chris Beardshaw. And you also had Philip Long, Chief Executive of the National Trust for Scotland, and you can see the parterre in its full glory, not from tomorrow, as I said earlier, but from today onwards. Yeah. It's a beautiful location.
I don't know, my garden's giving me permission to cut the grass today.
Oh, don't. You're just reminding me I need to cut mine as well. Anyway, tomorrow's a day we like to celebrate here and out of doors. We love it. It's right up our street, International Bog Day. Hurrah!
Hurrah!
We've visited a few bogs in our time, and this week you visited a cracker.
Yeah, I was up in the Flow Country in Caithness in Sutherland at Forsenard. It's the largest peat bog site in Europe and one of the most important ones. Ben Jones is site manager at RSPB Forsenard Flows, and I joined him in the amazing watchtower.
Right now we're looking out over a bog pool system. To some people, a bog is a loo, but to me, a bog is a place of nature, a place of quiet, a place of awe, really, and a bog pool system shows that off. On a calm day like today, you've got the sky reflected in them, so it's almost a view into a different world.
It's like a kind of bronze mirror, and just below me, we've got a wee island, which is, I don't know, about a metre and a half across, about a metre high. It is absolutely covered in bright red mosses and yellows and greens.
Yeah, that's what makes this landscape as beautiful, is getting down close to it, looking at the different colours of these sphagnum mosses. That's what we're seeing there. And that red one is sphagnum capillifolium.
That's pretty damned impressive. But this is a magnificent big, big landscape.
Yeah. There's different ways to enjoy this landscape. You can sit back and take it all in and look at the big skies and look at the relatively small hills, but in this landscape they look like big hills. Or you can get down on your hands and knees and really look at the small details, which are just as impressive.
And you can feel it as well. You can feel the movement.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you really can. If you've got a buddy out with you, then you can jump up and down and make each other move from a few metres away.
So the Flow Country, where is it? What are we looking at? Because we're surrounded on two sides by hills and mountains.
Yeah, so the Flow Country is 400,000 hectares of blanket bog in this northwest corner of Scotland. And Forsenard Flows covers about 21,000 hectares of it, kind of smack bang in the middle. And it's a landscape created by cool, wet conditions where the amount of rainfall is less than the amount that's evaporating away.
So what does a flow mean? Where does that come? Because I naively thought it was water flowing in.
Yeah, so flow actually comes from the Old Norse word floi, F-L-O-I, and in Old Norse that meant kind of wet or marshy, so it's quite fitting.
So how important is this in a, on a national scale, on a British scale, on a world scale?
Bogs are important to people on a personal level, but on a global scale, they're incredible carbon sinks. I think, obviously, keeping carbon locked in the ground, out of the atmosphere, is really important. And peatlands cover about 3% of the world's surface, but hold about 30% of the terrestrial carbon. So in Britain, our flow country here, up in the northwest, is holding 3 times as much carbon as all of our forests put together.
Wow. And you've applied for World Heritage status. I mean, that would be a bit of a coup.
Oh, yeah. It's really the accolade that this part of the world deserves. And it's a celebration of the blanket bog landscape and the biodiversity that lives here. And if you get World Heritage Site status, it's a statement. It's saying that this is the best example of this type of landscape, this type of biodiversity in the world. And it would put this site alongside the Great Barrier Reef, the Grand Canyon. And, yeah, I think that's really something that this place deserves.
Do you think folk are aware of it? Folk in Scotland, folk in Britain, that, you know, it's up there with the great natural areas of the world.
For some people, it's a secret, it's hidden. I think that, yeah, World Heritage Site status is going to put it on the map, of course. But in my dealings with the people putting together the World Heritage Site bid, a phrase that has come out that I quite like is that the flow country is a shy landscape, that it takes time to get to know it. So hopefully World Heritage Site status will encourage people to come up here, but not just, you know, drive through, see it in a day, take a photo and drive away, but, you know, spend a few days up here, really get to know the landscape and the wildlife.
And we're quite lucky to have it, because man's had a real go at bogs, and especially this one. They were determined to get rid of it.
Yes, so people have lived here for thousands of years. On your journey to Forsenard, you're passing burial cairns dating back to 4,000 years ago. Iron Age hill forts, there's actually one on top of the hill there, dating back to about 2,000 years ago. But it's largely been unchanged for the last few thousand years. So what we're looking out onto now is what our ancestors would have looked out onto. But in more recent history, the second half of the 20th century, our technology advanced and we were able to start planting trees and cutting drainage ditches into the bog, which has severely damaged it.
So what stage are you at saving it? Are you expanding it or just preserving what you've got?
So on the RSPB reserve, we're not just preserving the healthy bits of blanket bog that this part of the world is known for, but we're actually restoring those damaged parts. So we've taken down just over 2,500 hectares of plantation and started that journey from forestry back to bog.
And you've got International Bog Day coming up. You're going to have a big influx of folk. I mean, it's a great thing to hang on the opportunity to come and visit one of Scotland's great natural heritage sites.
Well, that's it. I think in the future, International Bog Day up here will be an even bigger event than it already is. And it certainly does bring people out to come and appreciate this landscape. And at Forsenard, we've got a couple of trails to choose from and a few places to sit and watch your wildlife and just appreciate the landscape. And yeah, hopefully in the future, we'll have bigger, better celebrations of this part of the world.
Ben Jones, site manager at RSPB Forsenard Flows. I remember about, must be about knocking on 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, the RSPB announced that we're going to be spending a lot of money taking these plantations down. And I thought, this is disgraceful, absolutely disgraceful. They're spending all this money, you know, and they should be using the timber. So I went up to Forsenard, and Norrie Russell, who we spoke to last week about the curlew, took me up onto the hill and he said, this plantation has been here for 20 years and the trees weren't as tall as I am. He says, they're never, ever going to get any bigger. He says, it's completely pointless. They were planted here for tax reasons. He says, they're never going to grow here. It's pointless. That's why we're taking them out. I thought, right, fine.
Yeah, but also, you know, International Bog Day, I think they need to change the name. But if you get a chance, take some waterproof clothes with you and just lie on the bog. Mm-hmm. And you can feel, lie down, close your eyes, and you can feel it, you can hear it. It's a living, pulsing thing. It's an absolute delight.
If you don't fancy taking the waterproof clothes, just get the train. Because the railway line across Forsenard was actually laid on fascines, big bundles of branches, and the train sways on that section of track. It's really enjoyable. Some areas of Scotland saw record-breaking temperatures at the start of this week. Some areas of the UK saw record-breaking temperatures at the start of this week. And while the highs may have been extremely short-lived, it looks like these extreme events are something we're going to have to get used to. Now, that was us thinking about trees, particularly in our towns and cities. I actually saw something, I think it was on Twitter, that suggested that a mature tree is the equivalent of something like, I don't know, I think it said 11 air conditioners. I thought, well, how does that work? Well, joining us now is someone who can hopefully answer that and much more. John Stokes, we've had him before, Director of Tree Science and Research for the Tree Council. Morning, John, how are you doing?
Good morning, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Now, do trees actually cool down towns and cities, and if so, how?
The simple answer to that is yes, they do. And the way they do it is through the movement of water. So what happens with a tree is it's sitting there when all those green leaves that it's got are absorbing sunshine. And in that, it has two effects. The first is that it reduces the amount of sunshine that hits the ground. So what's happening is you get a bit of shade, and under the tree it's a bit shady, and that cools the temperature. But more than that, what's going on in the leaf is that the tree is trying to do its thing of producing food, and that's a process called photosynthesis. And what happens in photosynthesis is carbon and water combine, and they produce sugar and the oxygen we need to breathe. But what happens is the tree is not, the process is not perfect. So not all of the water ends up being trapped in the tree as sugars. So what happens is the tree basically breathes out some water, and that water also has the effect of cooling the air around it. So that's called evapotranspiration, really lovely word, for basically letting water into the air. So you have this dual effect, the physical shade that exists because the tree is blocking the sunshine, and extra water being pumped into the atmosphere, and that water then just reduces the temperature and it makes it a bit cooler.
So how do we ensure that trees are going to be part of any new developments in our towns and cities? Because, you know, the Victorians were aware of how important trees are. Are we doing the equivalent? Are new projects incorporating trees into it?
So we would hope so. One would hope so. You're right. The Victorians planted legacies for the next generation. They thought about what we're doing for our children and grandchildren. They built into their design lots of space for trees. We don't necessarily do that now. We're trying to pack as many houses in as we can. But if we want to get to a place where we have a livable city for the future, then we need to start thinking about building in trees into the structure. And I know across Scotland there are all sorts of different projects that are going on. I know there's one in the Glasgow city region, which is called the Clyde Climate Forest. And there, they're trying to pack in another 1.5 million trees over the next 10 years to just increase the tree cover. And that will have the effect of reducing the temperature across Glasgow and making it a bit more of a livable city. So at a grand scale, we are at a sort of street by street basis. We've just got to find those opportunities that exist to have a tree or to have one in your garden. Any of that can help hugely.
What about, I mean, I've seen a lot of trees being taken down, certainly in Aberdeen and various other cities, and they don't seem to be replaced. Or am I wrong, or should they automatically, if they're cutting it down for whatever reason, or it's been blown down, they have to be replaced?
We really do need to keep our canopy. So we describe it as the canopy, the canopy of trees across the city. And we should really be, every place should be looking to set targets to make sure that if they have a tree reduced or felled or lost, that we put them back, and we put a few more back, because it's not really a one-for-one. If you've lost a big mature tree for whatever reason, it's going to take a while for little ones to come back. You know, they're going to take a long time to grow. So we need as many more trees going in as possible in all shapes and sizes. But we also need to make sure we're planting the right species. The thing about the Victorians was that they planted big forest trees, big trees that grew up above the roof line, and that produced shade for the houses, shade for the streets. We don't always replace trees with, you know, there are trees that grow smaller, sort of rowans and cherries and things that are never going to become big forest trees. So we also have to think not only about the numbers, but about the types of trees we're planting and making sure that we're planting trees that are going to give us the shade we need for the future.
When developers, you know, want to get rid of trees, you know, they get someone to come in and say, oh, this tree is ailing. Just about anything that is older will be imperfect.
Yes, there is definitely something in that. It is very difficult. One of the most important groups of trees in the nation are our ancient and veteran trees. And depending upon how you look at them, they're old, knobbly, gnarly, cranky old-looking things.
I know the feeling.
Me too. Which you could say are diseased and dangerous at one level, or fantastic survivors at another. You know, they've become old and knobbly and gnarly because they've got to that great age. And so it is in the eye of the beholder to some extent that we need to make sure that we don't look at every tree and just think because it's old and, you know, and gnarly that it's necessarily dangerous. Obviously, some can be, but it's not a universal truism that just because something's big that it needs to necessarily be dangerous.
Is there a problem with insurance companies? Because a lot of these Victorian planted trees are, by their very nature, close to buildings, and a lot of insurance companies don't like that. And people are taking them out because of that. It's a difficult one.
It's a really difficult one. I mean, one of the reasons for that is that you do that, or it is done, because there is this fear of subsidence, that the house will subside because the water's being... That water that's cooling the air is being taken out of the soil. That causes the soil to shrink, and that might cause problems with foundations. But that is really only true on soils that are shrinkable clays, on soils that can actually move with that loss of water. And many soils, I don't know about most, but certainly many soils aren't that shrinkable. And so there's this sort of blanket thought process that, oh, it's a tree, oh, it's near a building, oh, it's necessarily dangerous. And that isn't the case. Again, it can be, but it's a very specific set of circumstances that leads to that problem. And so it is a worry across the whole of the insurance industry that there is this sort of blanket view that trees and buildings don't work together. Build good foundations, build your houses properly, build your houses with the trees in mind. Contemplate that when you're having building works done. And in the States, for example, I've actually stayed in a house where there was a tree growing right up through the middle of the house. It was built as part of the design.
Absolutely lovely. No, that's fantastic. John, it's always a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
My absolute pleasure.
And evapotranspiration.
Well done. Never you're going to hear that at dinner party.
Never a dinner party will go by in future without me dropping it in there, and we'll just take it from there. Anyway, you're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. Just a reminder that we're actually taking the programme to the Edinburgh Festival this year. We'll be live from Edinburgh on Saturday the 13th of August. If you'd like to be in the audience for that, you can apply for tickets now. And it couldn't be simpler.
Hey, yeah, just go to BBC. Now, listen carefully, get a pen and paper.
Could be simpler.
Go to bbc.co.uk/shows and tours. That's bbc.co.uk/shows and tours. Go to the shows section of the site and search for Edinburgh Festivals. The link's also on our programme page. The ticket's going to be randomly drawn and you can apply at any time up until 11:55 on Monday the 25th of July. Never mind tea in the park, this is going to be great.
And among the guests joining us will be outdoor author and broadcaster Cameron Wheatney. So it'll be good to catch up with him.
Yeah, we'll probably put a mystery board to him, see how he's going. But people are starting to get it right, I think, now.
There are a few, however, wrong ones. Victoria in Edinburgh thinks it was a razor bill. Wendy from Montrose. The bird with a pretty call is a gannet, sadly found dead on our beaches. Not quite right, Wendy, not quite right. Callum from Arbroath says, think the mystery bird's a red-breasted merganser. The clues helped. Not that much, unfortunately. Stuart Taylor says, I'm stumped. But I've been confirmed by WhatsApp with my pal, Ian Walker, who thinks the mystery bird is a chuff. Give him a clip round the lug, Stuart. And Andy Ross and Bewley says, is it a golden plover? None of these are correct, but they're all good guesses.
Yeah, have a listen to this. If you know what that is, give Finn a call. 0808 592 95 00.
Moving away from the mystery bird altogether, turning our back on it, ignoring it completely, as a matter of fact, Weems Bay Railway Station sits on the Clyde coast and offers an easy route for the mainland to the ferry crossing across to Rothsay. It is, as I said earlier, an architectural gem. Maud Start caught up with Greg Beecroft from the Friends of Weems Bay Station. Now, as well as taking care of the flower displays and the concourse bookshop, Greg knows pretty well all there is to know about the history of the place.
The railway to Weems Bay was built in 1865 to provide a more convenient and quicker route from Glasgow down to Rothsay, the Isle of Bute and other places on the west coast. And it became very popular, so it was rebuilt in 1903. A bigger station meant they had to build a new seawall out into the Firth of Clyde, create additional space. So they built half the new station on the reclaimed land. Then they could divert the trains into it and knock down the old station and built the other half of the new station where the old one had been.
There's just one word really, really come out here. It's like, wow. It is, it's curves. It's just a circular, semicircular central ticket office. Describe to me what we're seeing.
Well, there's this grand semicircular concourse. It could, you know, accommodate a huge number of people, designed like this so that the flow of the crowd off the train was as smooth as possible. There was as little obstruction as possible. And this beautiful curved roof, when the sun's shining, which unfortunately it isn't today, it's really magnificent the way the light streams down. And then we've got the flowers on the concourse, which the Friends look after. But there's still other features on the station. Got the traditional bar and the cafe are still here. They're very popular.
And is it withstanding? I mean, there's a lot of glass on the roof here, and the weather can get quite rambunctious. How often do you have to replace these panels?
Well, replacing the glass is something that Network Rail has under consideration. One of the problems here is the seabirds. They find that the roof is a good place to drop shellfish because the shells break on the glass, but they also manage to crack the glass while they're doing it. So it's hoped that in time, as funds permit, that the glass can be replaced by some form of polycarbonate or another that will look just the same, but it will resist the seabirds.
So the part that we're walking into, it sort of sweeps down.
This
in
is the pier. And it leads down to where people join the ferry. Once upon a time, everybody would come down here. Today, it's just the foot passengers. In the 1970s, the ramp was put outside for the car ferry. What you probably don't immediately see, it's more clear if you look at an aerial photograph, is the graceful way the curve of the pier continues along the platforms. It's a continuous curve all the way through, basically called a lazy S, all the way through the station. I mean, it's a really clever design, as well as being, you know, really, really beautiful.
Do you think that some of the desire to travel, I mean, I know it came off the back of the Second World War when people would come on these local holidays, but like looking at the pictures of these steamers, it looks like a really exciting way to travel. Do you think that brought people out holidaying more than the ferries today?
Well, certainly the steamers were a big attraction. I mean, it was a tremendous advantage for Glasgow and, you know, the big industrial areas of Lanarkshire and Renfrewshire and Bartonshire, that, you know, you could get to somewhere that was so different, so wild, clean. No wonder it was popular. And you could come down here for a holiday, or you could just come for the day. But, you know, there were many people who could only afford to come, you know, say once a year for perhaps a week.
Ah, hello there. We've got a little boy. What's he doing?
This is a bronze statue of a small boy. He must be about 10 or 11, going on holiday. You can see he's dressed 1950s style. He was commissioned by us from a sculptor, Angela Hunter, as a memory of all the people who went on holiday. And he's a companion piece for another statue that's at Gurrock of a small girl sat on her suitcase, also waiting to go on holiday. And we find a lot of people get their photographs taken with him. And we also find he's very popular with children, because how often do you see a statue of a child?
Especially as such a happy, like, he's really managed to capture the face of of just pure glee. What's this he's carrying?
That's his fishing line.
And a little...
little yacht.
Do you have a name for this little fellow?
Yes, he's Bobby, and he's named after Robert Weems, who was a fisherman here a few hundred years ago, and after whom Weems Bay is said to be named, though the name is a bit controversial because the others claim it's derived from the Gaelic for a cave, but nobody's found a cave around here. But people don't often realise the Victorians built the railways principally for goods traffic, and the passengers were sort of secondary. Freight would go to the islands on the little puffers, you know, Parahandy and that. So this is quite an unusual railway in being built for principally with passengers in mind. But it also, we've got a feature over here that was ahead of its time, which you now find at airports.
Ooh, I'm intrigued.
And as part of getting passengers from the train to the ship as quickly as possible, one way to help that was to keep the luggage entirely separate. So you can see this platform here, the track has got a platform on both sides. And this platform on the far side, the wooden one, that was used for the luggage. And at the front of the train, there'd be the luggage van. And when it arrived, there'd be a load of porters stood there, and they would be waiting to get all the luggage out the van. There'd be there's a separate ramp down to the pier, and so that all your luggage, for those people who were posh enough to do luggage in advance and weren't like the masses who had to carry it themselves, so that all the luggage could be got out the way, not obstructing people. Just like airports now, but they were doing it 100 years earlier at Weems Bay.
Maud Start there speaking to Greg Beecroft of the Friends of Weems Bay Station. We knew how to do it in the old days.
Yeah, fascinating stuff, that whole flow of people and baggage and curves. And it sounds like a delightful wee station. I tell you, a lovely one, the RSPB at Forsenard. You get off the train in a delightful station and you're right on the bog.
Yes.
It's a great way to go and visit it. And they're advertising for a new warden. So if you fancy a life at Forsenard, rake around. Fantastic job. Brilliant place.
While we're on the subject of bog there, I remember saying to aforementioned Norrie Russell, you know, and of course, we were looking in the sort of the hag pools, you know, this dark, dark, peaty water. I said, of course, when it's a dry summer, this whole level will drop. You know, the water will drop in these pools. And he laughed and he said, no. When there's a dry summer, the entire landscape drops. What you're standing on is a floating sponge in a bowl of hills. It's one of those light bulb moments in my head. It's never really gone away. Time to hear another listener contribution to 100 Years of Scottish Stories, and this one comes from MacDonald family siblings, Hamish and Shona, who enjoyed many, many happy childhood adventures in their family motorcycle and sidecar.
100 Years of Scottish Stories on BBC Radio Scotland.
Looking back, it would have been the winter of 1966, and I was out playing football in the street in Clydebank, and this strange-looking object appeared. It was a motorbike and sidecar.
It was painted red and yellow, so you couldn't really miss it. Was it always painted that colour since we got it, Hamish?
No, when the motorbike first appeared, the nose was a kind of creamy colour, and my dad repainted it, and the bike itself was an old BSAB 31. It was quite a distinguished-looking machine, really. My dad took six of us on the motorbike and sidecar.
When you opened the door of the sidecar, there was a front seat and a back seat, but you all had to go in the one door. You opened the door to get in the sidecar, and then the back of the front seat was on a hinge, so you pulled that forward to get into the back seat. Then you sat down and you closed that hinge, then whoever was getting into the front would get into the front.
And what he did was he stuffed a lot of the gear into the nose of the sidecar, if you imagine the round nose.
And then all the mattresses and the sleeping bags, I think we sat in them inside the sidecar.
And then there was a wee roof rack on the sidecar, and the tent and various other things would be in that. Somebody got in touch with me and told me that there'd been a notice in the Evening Times that somebody was selling a BSA B31 500cc motorbike in Achiltibuie. and the guy was keeping the bike and a buyer, and went out to the buyer, and it was the same bike, took a couple of photographs of it. Front of it had been bashed in by the coups, and asked to see the book, and there was my dad's name and address on it. The fella wanted 400 quid for it, which I didn't have on me at the time, which is, my dad gave it away for a fiver.
And I think we were going to try and club together to buy it. By pure coincidence, I had saved up £400 for the deposit on a flat that I was about to rent. We actually had a serious debate as to whether I should give up my £400 and be homeless.
I would love to get it back. I think it's very, very unlikely. I've done a lot of online searches to see if I can find it. The registration, LVA397, is just completely etched in my consciousness. So I'll never ever forget that registration. And I've done quite a number of online searches. I've tried vintage motorbike sites and things like that, but I've never had any luck in trying to turn it up.
100 years of Scottish stories. Share your story. Head to bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland.
That's a great story. It's a great image in my head now. If you actually have that motorbike, it's a BSE B31, registration number LVA397. It would be fabulous to reunite it with Hamish and Shona.
Yeah, give us a call, 0808 592 95 00. You can have a go at the mystery bird as well, but if you've got that motorbike, give us a shout.
An old friend of this programme, former editor of Aberdeen Newsroom, Sandy Bremner, has been in touch to say, on the subject of the sun and glass causing fires, we had an incident many years ago at the BBC in Beechgrove. The rays of the early morning sun shone... Here's a wordsmith at work. The rays of the early morning sun shone through the newsroom window onto a crystal ball on my desk. It had helpfully been left to me by a former colleague. The ball focused the sun's rays on my phone, set it on fire, triggered the building alarm and a visit from the local brigade. The official advice afterwards from Grampian Fire Brigade was, please keep your ball under wraps. I think we'll leave it there.
Thank you, son. I do like a newsroom with a crystal ball, though.
Yeah, they haven't never quite mind. Got the hang of the idea that the stories... The idea, the whole point of the newsroom is to say stuff that has happened, past tense. Not that will happen, future tense. Never mind. Loch Katrine and the Trossachs have been attracting visitors for many years. In the late 1700s, poets such as Samuel Taylor Coleridge and Wordsworth visited, as well as Sir Walter Scott a little later. Now, the Sir Walter Scott Steamship Trust have got very ambitious plans for the area above the loch where Scott was inspired to write his poem, The Lady of the Lake. I spoke to James Fraser and Tom Wallace.
It's hard to imagine that the path you're on just now was once a track with 500 odd coaches and horses coming up after the publication of Sir Walter Scott's Lady of the Lake, and this is where he was inspired to write so evocatively about the Trossachs, as were Keating's and the Wordsworth and others. Yeah. And you've just come up an area that in the late 1700s was rock blasted to create the track for them all to come up here to admire the view, and then obviously thousands over the Victorian era came here to take in the view in the days when it was just rowing boats on the loch as opposed to the big passenger steamers in the first half of the 1800s.
I have to say, it is a tribute to the regenerative powers of nature, because I wouldn't have known there was a path up here, never mind a track up here that you could take carriages up.
Yes, well, the telltale signs are just to your right. If you look at the rock escarpment, there's actually a figure of eight where the old tracks used to be, and it was back in the days when they knew how to do visitor management and flows of traffic down the site.
One-way system.
But you can see traces of where it was rock blasted to create the plinth area in the top half of the path to allow the carriages to come up here safely.
Oh, hang on a second. Let's cop the view first, because we've actually just crested it. Now, there's trees in the way, but you do, or should, get a fabulous view right the way up the loch. That's beautiful, Tom.
Yeah, spectacular. Unless you're here to see it, you can't quite imagine it, because it's a completely different view of the loch than what you get from anywhere at a low level. Yeah.
What do you want to do here?
Well, I want to put a scenic tower and lookout in here. I mean, the history of the site is it was Roderick Dhu Watchtower, but in reality there was two wicker huts here, the first glamping pods in Scotland in the late 1700s, which Lady Drummond of Perth built to allow painters, writers to come here and do their stuff about the landscape, and that's obviously what led to the birth of tourism. So you're actually standing just now on what the site is credited with being the birthplace of Scottish tourism. So we want to celebrate that with the natural heritage. We want to put in an evocative tower, a sleek timber tower with three levels with lookouts, and then a bridge, a safe bridge across to two St Lookouts, so you can get wider panoramas of the loch and the mountains surrounding us.
So the towers will be here, but up there is you're going to go up to.
You'll go up a spiral to level one in the tower, and then you'll go on a timber bridge across to the top level where the view really opens up more. Fantastic, fantastic panorama.
Tom's cheating, he's actually got a diagram. Here's one I imagined earlier. That's about another 10, 15 feet up.
Jim says you'd be up in the first level back there, then transported across above the heathers here to probably the most spectacular point of the view, looking right up the length of Loch Katrine.
Wow.
I'm seeing Benan on your right and surrounded by the Trossachs, and there's the views from Benan are spectacular, but there's nothing quite like this.
You know what really astonishes me? The fact that, I mean, the car park is about 100 feet below us. You'd have no idea it was there.
You wouldn't. It's pretty silent up here, but you have dramatic views along the Loch Shore, but also to Ellen's Isle, which Sir Walter wrote about, evocative villains, Lady of the Lake. And if you think back to Rob Roy's time, this is where the clan chief, Roderick Dhu, and his clansmen would be sitting, looking to the south, looking out for, and there wouldn't be the tree cover that is here now, and looking to the south for redcoats. So the early warning system triggering Rob Roy and his men becoming the Children of the Mist and disappearing at the hills.
Children of the Mist, all of it. And who was Roderick Dhu?
Roderick Dhu was a fellow clan chief of Clan MacLaren, and he was a great pal of Rob's, obviously. So, but he allegedly they were fighting for the favours of Ellen, and that's why the island in front is called Ellen's Isle. And he writes about that quite strongly within the Lady of the Lake, and amongst describing evocatively the scenery you're looking at. I mean, over to your east, Benan, and you see the dots of people on the summit, very popular. And then to the west, you're looking to Benbu, and you're looking right up the throat of the loch, up to the Crean Larrach Hills, and over to Balwhidder. So it really is a stunning panorama for, I would say, less able people. Yes, you couldn't get up here with wheelchairs, but a lot of people will manage to come the 200 metres, and with the path, we're planning to have post and rail fencing and safety fencing around here as part of the scenic lookouts, really taking our inspiration from what they've done in some of the American national parks and some of the John Muir spirit in terms of people rediscovering the magic of the Trossachs.
That will actually blend very well, Tom, into the local environment.
Yeah, and that's been paramount to all of the work that we're doing here. It's about recognising the unique nature of this area and reinstating a path that's in keeping with the surroundings and introducing a viewpoint that complements it and really feels at home within part of it. So I think, as you can see from the drawings, the aim is to get something here that people can use to access the area, but it really blends in with surroundings. Yeah.
What's the timescale for this?
Well, we're hoping to go out to tender very shortly for the path build, with a start this autumn, subject to mountain path builders being available, because it's all to be hand-built, so it's to be carefully built to minimise the impact on the environment. And we're just finalising a bid for the funding for the tower and the scenic lookouts, which, if we're successful through the Visit Scotland Rural Tourism Infrastructure Scheme, that would commence March next year and be ready for early summer. So we could be standing here this time next year, I'd hope to think, and you're on one of the scenic lookouts or on the tower with lots of people here enjoying it safely and responsibly.
The very spot where Dorothy Wordsworth sat and found inspiration.
It is. It's where Keating shouted down that Dorothy and Willie were rowing up in a boat up to the Trossachs Pier area, and he hailed down, he hailed Caledonia and the famous quotes, and invited them up for, I assume it was a cup of tea, or it might have been a dram at the time, and they were up here, and she wrote eloquently about here as well as part of one of her many tours of Scotland.
It's great that it's got this history, Tom, but there's a now to this place too.
Yeah, very much so. So back in the day when this landscape inspired those writers, the The landscape's evolved since then. As you said earlier on, nature has recolonised some areas that were once incredibly popular. So what we're wanting to do here is utilise this opportunity of reinstating what was once there as a means of engaging people with the environment now, and recognising both the cultural and environmental importance of this area, which ties directly in with the National Park aims and the fact that this is such a protected and recognised space as well.
Tom Wallace and James Fraser of the Sir Walter Scott Steamship Trust there. And we'll hear more from Lochatron next week as the steamship Sir Walter Scott undergoes repair.
It's a great location. If you get yourself a copy of Lady of the Lake, it's a great place. If you go up the head of the loch and just read it, that opening bit where the stag hunt and the stag manages to outrun the hunt, and it's a lovely tale, and it's well worth reading.
Absolutely.
They should have public readings of it.
I'm sure there's an opening there for you, just waiting for you. Time now for the mystery bird to be revealed. First, we'll do a quick scoot through some correct answers. You've got some, haven't you?
No, not yet.
So you haven't? All right, it's on its way, no doubt. Gordon Brown and Ethie Bridge got the correct answer. Keith Sutherland and Blair Gowrie. Pamela and Alan from Edinburgh. Sam and Kingswells. Malcolm Spears and Lanark. Susie from Spot. Janet Martin in Auchinriach. Kevin and Tobermory. John McKenzie in Orkney. John from Langham. And Catherine Jarvis in Starport and Severn. Worcestershire said, "The whistling just sealed it." She got the correct answer, but Pete Cooper at King Usey, we'll give the answer just now, says, "Is it a widgeon? And is it called that because it looks like it has a wig on?" No, that's a fabrication.
I don't know about that. That could well be that, because it's got, as I said, it's called a bald pate, because it's got that distinctive mark on it. Correct answers from Glenn Campbell, says it's a widgeon. Tony in Fort William. Donald says it's a widgeon. Linda from Culty Braggin. David Long from Spottiswood. Angus Ian. Paddy in Aberdeen, Bill Higgins, East Kilbride, Donald Smith, Recreef, and George Conway in Dalry, who correctly said it was a widgeon. The clan were unhappy. Below them, the sound of Harris ebbed and flowed in the heat of the summer sun. Seals basked on the rocks. Eagles revelled in the thermals that rose over the hot sands. And schools of dolphin wove and dived and frolicked in the joy of the season. But the Clan MacCandy were immune to this spectacle of nature, for things had come to a head. They were divided. The Druid had been summoned from his isolation on the Sheance and waited and deliberated, for this was a defining moment in the proud history of the clan. For generations, the folk of Bernary had toiled on this land. The soil was thin and rock was a constant enemy. Each spring, baskets of kelp were gathered from the beach and spread on the land. Earth was heaped into the runrigs of the Western Isles. Dung from the animals mixed into the macker. But it was a relentless battle against time and tide, for no amount of weed from the sea will turn soil into boundless pasture. Some vegetables, potatoes, kale, just enough to keep a family alive, but no way to ensure the survival of future generations. The time had come. Others on other islands had already taken the big step at the hands of the Druid. On North Uist, the MacCondrums had taken the plunge. A plunge which is seen to this day in the form of the Blue Men of the Minch. The seal-like men who laugh and dance and revel in the choppy waters of Harris. For the Druid had in his hands a staff. A staff which could shape the destiny of a tribe. The hardships of Uist had seen them call for another life. And with the pointing of the staff, the call to the gods and the power of the Celtic underworld, the clan had been transformed into the men who can call storms and live on the bounty of the sea. And now the folk of Bernary were at the same point of decision. With all the will of the clan, they still could not feed the population, and some would simply have to go. They split down family lines. Some were followers of the sun and chose the land. Others, followers of the moon and chose the sea. Those of a maritime persuasion lined the beach with their backs to the land. The druid raised his staff as the new moon rose, and in an instant, they gave forfeit to human form and saw the coming knight in the shape of the lach, with the distinctive wedge-shaped tail of the widgeon. For in Celtic culture, the bird is seen as a totem of intuition and with the gift of foresight. An ability to connect with our higher being of secret knowledge and wisdom. And there are still those of a certain age on the islands which pepper the sound of Harris, who see the effortless grace of the bird gliding with the tide, or seemingly flying through the storm with ease, who envy those of the clan who took to the air, to the sea, the moon and the stars. And it's said that when the long-tailed widgeon utters his sharp, impatient cry, he's simply sneering at his less fortunate brethren who stupidly remained to scratch a living from the macker of Bernard. The widgeon. Ben had no idea what it was, he says, but this cry certainly frightened our cat Freya, who was sleeping peacefully whilst I was listening to your programme in our summer house with Ox and Craig, Captain Clouds in the distance. I just love these true stories of whole clans being turned into widgeon.
There is a legend.
Well, there, yeah, there is a legend. Colin Campbell's been in touch. Now, I'm trying to get my head around this. He said, I'm enjoying the show an hour ahead in France. Mm-hmm. Managed to see nesting storks in Celestat. Is the mystery bird a Eurasian widgeon? Well, yes, it is. But if he's listening an hour ahead, are we already finished?
I don't know. Well, you see, that's a philosophical question. I can't go with that. Keith in Hartford says, well, we were talking about raspberries earlier, which reminded me, when I went to a beer festival a few years ago, I tried raspberry-flavoured stout, or porter, and adds, I've never tasted anything so foul.
Richard Nelson's in Lithgow. He said, gents, my family and I are off to North Harris today. Yay, great joy. Excellent. Watch out for widgeon.
Well, you never know. It'd be beautiful, actually, if you get the weather across in Harris. It's just brilliant. Stunning. The beaches are superb. That, sadly, is all from us this week. Don't forget our New Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon. And our midweek podcast, this really interested me because it features a farmer who doesn't actually own any land. It's a very, very clever system. You know, and it's something I hadn't really given any thought to. Anyway, until the next time, from all the team, thanks for listening.
There's never been a better time to do business in Western Australia. Our network of global investment and trade offices connects you to our world-leading industries and highly skilled workforce. Western Australia. It's like no other.